forward an additional sanctions bill knowing that might wreck the talks?
Well, first of all, I'd say we've waited for more than months. We've waited now for close to over a year, and really no serious progress has been made. And on the contrary, a number of concessions have been made by the United States. In fact, now the U.S. has conceded the right to enrich or reprocess. And if you give them the right to enrich or reprocess at any level, that infrastructure could very easily be ramped up in the future to produce nuclear-grade uranium or plutonium. Second, I would say that probably the first vote will be something that will require any deal to come before Congress for approval, the way a treaty would. Additional sanctions will probably be put in as being triggered by a failure to reach an ultimate agreement. That's my sense of how this is shaping up. Of course, there are other opinions here about how we should move forward.
So it sounds like your sense is then, Senator, that you would let the negotiations play out, however skeptical you are, but Congress might say to the president, look, we expect you to come to us for approval.
Well, I'm prepared to vote for additional sanctions today. I'm not sure if that's a majority position. I think it could be, but I think that's something we'll have to debate.
Let me ask about immigration, Senator Rubio, because President Obama spoke of his executive action that allows temporary legal status for millions of people. The president now says he does want Congress to finally act on immigration reform. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Does it spur them to work once again with Democrats in my administration to get a reasonable piece of legislation done? Does it simply solidify what I do think is a nativist trend in parts of the Republican Party. And if it's the latter, then probably we're not going to get much more progress done, and it'll be a major debate in the next presidential election.
Senator Rubio, do you see it as the president sees it?
I don't. First of all, I think the use of nativist to describe opposition to his form of immigration reform is inaccurate and unwise. I think there are very legitimate reasons to believe that this country has a right to have immigration laws and to have those laws respected. 1 million people a year come to the U.S. legally. And there aren't any voices out there saying that that should be stopped. Now, there are voices, including my own, saying that how we immigrate to the U.S. should be reformed. It should be more of a merit-based system and less of a family-based system because of the dramatic economic changes that we've had in the 21st century, where it's difficult for low-skill workers to find jobs.
There certainly are people that we have interviewed in our travels around the country who express concern about immigration and how it is changing the United States. They express attitudes that you could describe as nativist, I would think. Is that actually a small part, at least in your view, of the Republican Party, and does that complicate your efforts?
Yeah, I believe it's a very small part of the Republican Party. I believe it's a very small part of the American people. The vast majority of people I've spoken to just want to see our laws enforced. And that's the point that's not talked about enough. No one has a right to illegally immigrate to this country. And what we're being asked to do here is to ignore the fact that we have immigration laws because of the human aspects of the story. So certainly there are compelling humanitarian stories and exceptions made for some of those, especially when it comes to political asylum or people fleeing near certainty of death. But we also have a country that has to apply immigration laws. And the vast majority of people I've talked to, that's all they're asking for, is for us to have an immigration system that functions and that works.
Although if we think about what happened in the last Congress, ultimately Republicans could not agree among themselves on immigration bills that they could support. Why do you think the Republican Party is having such trouble making up its collective mind?
Well, actually, it's a pretty straightforward disagreement. There are those who, and they're open to doing the sorts of things we've talked about with regards to those who have been here illegally for a long period of time, but they don't believe we should do anything about that until first illegal immigration is brought under control. And the reason they believe that is twofold. One, because they've been made promises in the past that enforcement would happen in exchange for some form of amnesty, and the amnesty happened, but the enforcement never came. And the other is because they fear that the announcement of these changes in our immigration laws would spur people to try to come into the U.S. illegally. And they point to the crisis we had in the border over the summer with young people in Central America who were misinformed by trafficking gangs that somehow the U.S. had created new laws that allowed them to come and stay. And I think that's where the disagreement has been, is they felt that the bill we passed out of the Senate didn't have enough guarantees that the enforcement would happen.
That's Florida Senator Marco Rubio in our first political talk of 2015. Rubio is considering a run for president, and we ask him about that elsewhere in today's program. The kind of New Year celebration that people joined around the world overnight turned grim in Shanghai. Thousands of people gathered in Shanghai's Bund, a famous waterfront district, and then a stampede killed around 36 people. The BBC's John Sudworth is covering this story from Shanghai. Can you just tell us where you are and what you're seeing?
Well, I'm on Shanghai's Bund, Steve, the historic waterfront area. It's one of the sort of iconic parts of this city. Shanghai itself, of course, an iconic showcase city of China. So that this could have happened here at all will cause deep concern. Crowds were gathered here last night. This is a traditional gathering place for the New Year's celebration. Many, many thousands turned out. Around 20 minutes before the stroke of midnight, there was a crush, a stampede. The crowd jammed very closely together between this historic sweep of old colonial buildings and the river. A large space, but nonetheless the sheer volume of numbers meant that that crush turned into a very serious incident. And as you say, dozens of people killed, more than 40 injured, some of them seriously, and taken to a number of hospitals.
Is it clear what would have caused people to stampede?
We don't know yet. There is speculation on social media based on eyewitness accounts that it may have been triggered by somebody throwing fake money, basically coupons being used in one of the clubs and bars here to be exchanged for drinks as part of the New Year celebrations. Coupons printed in the form of $100 bills. According to reports from the scene, somebody was throwing those coupons out of a balcony down to the crowd below, and it seems as if at least one possible explanation is that as people rushed forward to try and collect what they thought was real money, that caused this stampede. There is no official confirmation of that. The authorities here in Shanghai say they are launching an investigation, but that's one possible cause that I think will be looked at very carefully.
Nevertheless, an element of mystery here, because you say this is a place where people traditionally gather. They would have been accustomed to it. The authorities would have been accustomed to controlling the crowds. A very strange event.
Well, it's interesting, Steve, because this has been a traditional gathering place, and for the last few years there's been a sort of an official celebration, an official fireworks display and light show. And last week, the Shanghai authorities announced that that part of the celebrations has been cancelled this year. It wasn't going to be held out of a concern, we understand, for public safety. There were something like 300,000 people along this riverfront last year. Clearly, they felt that there was a potential for something to go wrong. So what's interesting is it looked as if somebody had anticipated the possibility of trouble. The official part of the event had been cancelled in the hope that it would keep numbers low. But nonetheless, large crowd turned out. And I think the inquiry, you'd expect, you'd hope perhaps, will ask questions as to whether enough was done to anticipate the sort of numbers who would be here last night and whether the right kind of resources were in place in terms of policing manpower and emergency services to make sure that people were safe.
The BBC's John Sudworth is in Shanghai. Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:18. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. It's an historic day for major college football. The first playoffs begin later today. We'll have a preview at about 8:40. Our weather today should be cloudy and cool, with a chance of snow and afternoon highs in the low to mid-20s.
Attention all Facebook users, you're invited to click Like WGTD for breaking news, photos, station program information, links to archives, and to interact with WGTD employees and listeners. The page is available to non-Facebook subscribers as well.
His family's future without him. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support local theater productions. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. The new year is here, and a million people crowded into New York's Times Square to welcome 2015. That music courtesy of Countdown Entertainment and the Times Square Alliance that put on the celebration. But not all of the New Year's celebrations were joyous. 35 people died in a stampede in Shanghai. Analysts are predicting auto sales for December could be the best in 8 years. We can thank falling gas prices, low interest rates, and improving unemployment for lifting sales. NPR's Sonari Glinton says there are no guarantees, though, the trend will continue this year.
Some of the problems that could be on the horizon, a weakening economy in China and a weak economy in Europe, have put some stress on the auto industry, but you see this overall health based on what's happening in the U.S.
Automakers will report their December sales on Monday. The stock market is closed today due to the holiday. For all of 2014, the market saw solid gains. The Dow was up 7%, the S&P gained 11%, the NASDAQ up 13%. Well, today's Rose Bowl parade could be one of the coldest on record. A cold air mass is sweeping in. Officials are advising parade watchers to bundle up. For the first time in 30 years, float decorators had to suspend decorating. I'm Nancy Lyons.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. A man from Illinois has pleaded not guilty to killing his wife with a hatchet in Wisconsin. Christian Logan Negri entered a not guilty plea to charges of first-degree murder, mayhem, and kidnapping at a preliminary hearing yesterday in Racine. Prosecutors say he killed Roxana Abruden in Mount Pleasant last month. She was injured there and died later at a suburban Milwaukee hospital. Alaska state troopers say they have no record of a 72-year-old Wisconsin man leaving that state. The agency is asking the public for help as it searches for Roger Yeager of Eagle River. He went to Alaska last summer to view wildlife. Relatives last heard from him August 8th when he visited family in Wasilla. He then traveled to Fairbanks, where he turned in his rental car, then seemingly disappeared. Relatives in Wisconsin reached out to law enforcement when they didn't hear from Yeager and he failed to answer emails. One family member said he revealed plans to travel around Alaska and said he would contact them at about Christmas time, but so far that hasn't happened. Wisconsin State Parks officials say a New Year's Day hike could be a great way to start the new year. The Department of Natural Resources is hosting First Day Hikes events at 11 state parks today. They're part of a nationwide initiative led by America State Parks to get people outdoors with more than 400 hikes scheduled this year in all 50 states. The hikes encourage people to explore popular summer destinations in the winter. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing online access to ratings and reviews of local companies to help consumers achieve their home improvement goals, whether that be a remodeled kitchen, a freshly painted house, or a new backyard. Learn more at angieslist.com. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. From Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change. And from the Mark Haas Foundation, supporting the arts, education, and medical research since 1981.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. An old political saying goes, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. Americans are following this advice whether they live in Washington or not. In many states, the demand for dogs now outstrips the supply of those available for adoption. Shelters in some states now import dogs from other regions and even other countries, which is leading to concern about what's called dog trafficking. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Just north of Boston, the Northeast Animal Shelter is one of the largest private shelters in New England. It started in the 1970s, but about 6 years ago, it went through a big expansion, building a new 13,000-square-foot shelter with three isolation rooms. The rooms were designed to house the increasing number of dogs the shelter transports from other states and Puerto Rico.
This room here is the room that has 10 kind of dog stalls in it.
Lori McCannon is the director.
These dogs actually just arrived to us on Saturday from Tennessee, so they will get their health checks today. It's been almost 48 hours to when our vet comes in tonight.
In another isolation room are some of the 20 dogs that arrived at the shelter a few days earlier, flown in from Texas. In its early days, Northeast Animal Shelter used to place about 300 dogs a year in new adopted homes. Last year, McCannon says, they adopted out 4,400 dogs, three-quarters of them from out of state.
Started out with Puerto Rico and then went to a great shelter in Nebraska that we worked with forever. I think at one point we actually dealt with five different shelters in Georgia alone.
Shelters tell a similar tale throughout New England and the Northeast, also in the U.S. Northwest and the Great Lakes region. Decades of spay and neuter programs, combined with a strong participation by rescue groups, have greatly reduced the number of unwanted dogs and cats. McCannon says it's a different story in rural states and in the South.
Even though the South still has a lot of work to do with spay-neuter laws and, you know, getting people to feel that pets are more companions in parts of their family than yard dogs or that kind of thing.
Some people point to Hurricane Katrina as a turning point. Efforts to rescue and find new homes for dogs stranded in New Orleans showed groups a new way to find homes for unwanted dogs. Now, a network of shelters and rescue groups transport tens of thousands of dogs each year from other states and other countries. Patty Strand is director of the National Animal Interest Alliance, an organization that represents the American Kennel Club and other dog breeders. She calls it retail rescue.
There is a lot of money in this new kind of rescue that has emerged, and these groups move dogs from just about any place that they can get them.
Exactly how many dogs are being transported is unknown. The USDA doesn't track how many dogs are transported across state lines or even how many are imported by rescue groups from other countries. Some states, though, do.
In 2012, 14,000 animals were brought into Connecticut from other states.
Arnold Goldman is a veterinarian in Connecticut who's been concerned about the booming interstate movement of dogs. He's seen a lot of health issues like mange and heartworm as a result. And he says there's a deeper issue.
There are Connecticut origin animals in our brick and mortar shelters who wait for homes themselves. And there is something disconcerting about that.
Rescue groups are finding unwanted dogs to transport in the South and in other countries, including Mexico, Taiwan, and India. Those are all countries where rabies is endemic in the dog population. Strand says the concern about rabies is more than theoretical.
We've had a dog with rabies come in from Iraq. One came in from India, Thailand. We've had a dog from Puerto Rico that wound up in a shelter in Massachusetts with rabies.
In Massachusetts, Connecticut, and some other states, regulations have been tightened in recent years, requiring rabies certificates and quarantine periods. But problems persist. Last year, a puppy transported to Vermont and adopted by a family was euthanized after it developed rabies. The Association of State Public Health Veterinarians has asked the Federal Centers for Disease Control to ban the import of dogs from countries where rabies is endemic. Greg Allen, NPR News.
Let's get a music recommendation now. Each month, NPR Music asks public radio hosts and DJs to tell us about a new song they play on the air a lot, a song in heavy rotation. And recently, we asked DJs to reflect on some of their biggest songs of the year just past. Benji McPhail of KUNC nominated the song Hey Mommy.
Sopranesso is a duo out of Durham, North Carolina. The thing that makes the vocals so appealing, the woman is named Amelia Meath. Nick Sanborn is her partner, and he gives her a lot of room to really project that voice.
She rockets her thighs, she rockets her thighs, she rockets her thighs. Oh, lady, she don't know how she goes.
It almost feels like it's recorded on a street corner somewhere. She's walking so fast, you know, you've got this mental picture of a woman kind of going, you know, through the street corner. Catcalling is definitely an aspect. It's just part of the street scene that they created at the beginning, I think. You know, she might be walking past a construction zone. In fact, there are parts where the music really does sound like, you know, there's hammering or there's people working on jackhammers. Really isn't until, you know, about a third of the way through that you realize that there's a lot more to this song than just the vocal performance. And, you know, that's when it kind of pulls you in even more. This is the only band I can think of where they combine a street corner kind of a cappella sound with an electronic sound. And in theory, that really shouldn't work. But for whatever reason, the combination works for these guys, and it works really well.
That was KUNC's Benji McPhail talking about Sylvan Esso's song, Hey Mommy. You can hear that and many others on our heavy rotation music stream at npr.org/music.
Hey, mama.
Nice music to wind down the New Year's party on Morning Edition from NPR News.
When troops serve, they sometimes leave young children at home.
If a parent can't be there themselves, they want to know that their kid's, like, taken care of and safe.
The military has them covered.
200,000 children and 800 centers, 3,500 family child care homes.
The military's child care system later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3, right after classical music. See our complete schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We are not going to say a word right now about 2014. We'll just use a symbol. It's an emoji, one of those drawings in a text message that's supposed to show how you feel. The Global Language Monitor's top word of 2014 is not a word. It's an emoji of a heart. The company says the spread of pictures in place of words reflects a broader transformation of English. Fine with me as long as there's a picture of somebody rolling his eyes. You're listening to Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio on this first day of 2015. Egypt's high court has canceled the jail sentences of three Al Jazeera journalists and ordered a retrial. News organizations across the world have been demanding their release from prison. The journalists say they were jailed for doing their jobs. We'll bring you their story at 8:45.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a place to call home. Familiar voices, timely conversations, uplifting entertainment. Nearly 500,000 listeners tune in every week, benefiting from the programs made possible thanks to WPR member support.
From the WGTD Earth's another events calendar, the Kenosha County Health Services Division encourages everyone to get an influenza vaccine. People with asthma are at higher risk of complications due to the flu. Visit chawisconsin.org to learn tips to help keep you healthy this winter.
Tune into Wisconsin Public Television Tuesday night at 8 when American Experience presents Ripley, Believe It or Not. Discover the story of Robert Ripley, a curious man who made us believe the unbelievable and mesmerized the nation with his blend of homespun Americana and freakish oddities. American Experience, Ripley, Believe It or Not. Tuesday night at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television.
Well, the weather on this first day of the year should be cloudy and relatively cool, mild even for this time of year, with highs in the low to mid-20s, a chance of snow as well. Getting very cold tonight with partly cloudy skies and lows from 4 below to 5 above. Temperatures should be seasonal until early next week when we're looking at highs in the single digits on Monday. Right now, Superior 21, Madison 14, and Green Bay 16.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international correspondents who take great risks to keep listeners informed. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices, waltonk12.org. And from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors on the web at pamm.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. There's a reason so many people make New Year's resolutions. More than any specific goal, people yearn for a chance for a fresh start. On this New Year's Day, NPR begins a series of reports called Starting Over. We tell stories of people who had to reinvent themselves. First, we travel to the mountains of Colorado, where a congregation has returned to their chapel after flooding destroyed the building. They've restored the building now, but KUNC's Grace Hood reports the real challenge lies ahead.
Chapel of the Interlude is a fitting name for a church in the middle of a narrow, winding canyon. In 1969, benefactors built the intimate wood-paneled structure to provide an oasis next to one of the busiest roads leading to Rocky Mountain National Park.
Well, good morning.
In 2013, a raging river between Estes Park and Loveland, Colorado, deposited mud, sticks, and debris inside the chapel's fellowship hall. After stripping down the walls and carpet to remove mold and water damage, about 40 of its members have returned, including Harry Fitchner.
There's a lot of work, there's a lot of strain, a lot of stress, but We just kept coming together.
Decked out in suspenders, a handlebar mustache and beard, the 68-year-old tinkers with a new thermostat.
You see what we've got today? It's just building right back.
The church shed its 60s wood paneling for white walls and a tile floor. But one hurdle down, another to go. That's what it's like when you're starting over. Bus Tarbox, who's attended Interlude for 10 years, lays out the dilemma.
We have very few young people. We don't have any children. So we're going to have to appeal to the people who live up here. And so far, we haven't been real successful in doing that.
The average age in this congregation is 75. The oldest member just turned 101. Inside the tiny sanctuary, Pastor Dave Orison kicks off the service.
What are we thankful for this morning?
I'm thankful.
One churchgoer who's 90 says she's happy to finally get scheduled for an MRI.
If they don't hurry and find out why you're sick, you might just get well first, right?
Orison then starts a service he describes as gentle and non-abrasive.
All right, let's go to the Lord in prayer. Our Heavenly Father,
everything from Orison's delivery to use of traditional hymns is by design. Rock music may help fill the church pews, he says, but it can alienate those who are older.
I think many pastors have been pushed into the idea that growth is so important that disenfranchising certain groups is acceptable.
Orison says there's a delicate balance between bringing in younger members and retaining the older ones.
They're 90 years old. I mean, we have several of them who are 90 years old. I'm not going to encourage them to get out there and knock on doors and tell their neighbor that they need Jesus, you know?
And there are limits to how many people Chapel of the Interlude can recruit. The new sanctuary is already cramped. With overflow seating, they're squeezing in 60 people. After Sunday service, the congregation snacks on brownies and cookies. Liz Fitchner, one of the youngest members at 55, says she loves the small community and from-the-heart sermons. Building up the church is about connecting with the right people.
See, before the flood, there was a house and a lot of trees in front of the church. You never knew there was a church here.
Now Fitchner says the house and trees are gone. Their oasis is more exposed.
So trying to bring some of the regular traffic maybe to come here and put it out that we're back open, that we're here again, worshiping together.
Chapel of the Interlude doesn't have a whole lot of extra space, but when you're starting over, there's plenty of room for growth. For NPR News, I'm Grace Hood.
The first day of 2015 is a historic day for college football. The first ever playoff in the game's highest division begins today. We've got two semifinal games, Oregon against Florida State, and later Alabama takes on Ohio State. NPR's Tom Goldman is so excited he can barely contain himself. Hi, Tom.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Of course, this is something that sports fans, college football fans, have been demanding for quite some time. But would you explain how the world is different today?
We have these two playoffs, and people will be able to say, well, now we have a national champion who's proving it on the field. There was always this complaint that the national championship was settled by polls and computers and not on the field, but you've got four teams playing, then the winners will play for the title a week and a half later. It gives more a sense that the winner earned it.
Two of them, of course, are Florida State and Oregon, each with a great quarterback.
Yeah, that's the headline here. This year's Heisman Trophy winner, Oregon's Marcus Mariota, he's an athlete as dangerous running as he is passing, and he has been pretty darn good passing with 38 touchdown passes, only two interceptions. Then there's Florida State's Jameis Winston, the 2013 Heisman winner, not as efficient as Mariota. He had 24 touchdown passes, 17 interceptions, but Winston led the Seminoles to another undefeated season. The team has won 29 straight. They are the defending national champion. It's also billed as a quarterback matchup of good guy versus bad guy, a morality play here. Winston's troubles are well known, from his shoplifting charge to a rape allegation that he's been cleared on twice. He has been brash and immature, at least off the field. On the other hand, the media and Oregon fans have placed a halo over Mariota's head. He's a nice guy, very humble, polite, the pride of Hawaii. Although he's not perfect, Steve. He got a speeding ticket in November for going 80 in a 55-mile-per-hour zone.
But of course, on the field, what people might focus on is the fact that you have one quarterback who's thrown a lot of interceptions and another who's hardly thrown any. Who's got the advantage?
Oregon is favored, a very explosive offense, but Florida State is dangerous. The Seminoles have won a bunch of close come-from-behind games. They're the underdogs, and you know they can use this us-against-the-world feeling as motivation. Also, Oregon is missing a key defensive player, cornerback Ifo Ekpre Olamu. He's out with a knee injury. That could make things easier for Florida State's top wide receiver, Rashad Green.
Now, the other game here, we've got Alabama against Ohio State. For a Midwesterner like me, it's always a tough moment of deciding whether you are going to, you know, just kind of ancestrally despise Ohio State because you grew up a Purdue fan, or you're going to root for the Big Ten. But what's going to happen in this game?
Well, you've got a typical Alabama team, big and skilled. They are the class of this four-team field. Bama is a 10-point favorite, but Ohio State comes in on a roll, playing its best football at the end of the season. But they've also got a third-string quarterback going. They lost their top two quarterbacks to injury. Cardale Jones was great against Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, but tonight is only his second career start. He's going against a fearsome defense that most likely will stop the run and put even more pressure on an untested quarterback. Alabama is very tough on offense and defense. And lest we forget, Steve, it's also a matchup of two of the best college coaches, Alabama's Nick Saban against Ohio State's Urban Meyer.
NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks very much.
Why, thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41. We're glad you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Happy New Year. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, we'll catch up with technology giants and startups at the 2015 Consumer Electronics Show. Our weather today, cloudy and mild, a chance of snow with highs in the low to mid-20s.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you to the 50,000 individuals and families and nearly 600 business sponsors who made donations to WPR in the last year. Thanks to your commitment, smart programs that inform, inspire, entertain, and engage have a home on the air, on your mobile device, and online at WPR.org. You make WPR a great resource for Wisconsin and beyond, and we're so grateful for your support.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. Chinese President Xi Jinping is ordering an investigation into a stampede at Shanghai's historical riverfront during last night's New Year's Eve celebrations. The incident left at least 36 dead. Kui Tingting, a woman who witnessed the incident, said the stampede occurred on a stairway.
It's too cruel. People in front of us had already fallen to the ground, and other people were stepping all over them. It wasn't an urgent occasion like a terrorist attack where you need to run to save your life. People just needed to leave the site. We felt death so close to us last night. We were horrified.
One hospital official says some of the victims died of suffocation. The U.S. State Department says the Palestinian decision to join the International Criminal Court is counterproductive. Mustafa Baghouti, a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, defends the move.
This will allow every Palestinian from now on and every human rights organization in the world to hold the Israeli officials accountable for the war crimes and crimes against humanity that they've committed in the Palestinian territories.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Palestinian Authority should fear the judgments of the court. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is stepping down from all his board memberships. It is seen as another sign that he is eyeing a 2016 presidential bid. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. The Milwaukee Police Department says an outside group has disabled its news website. MilwaukeePoliceNews.com was taken offline Tuesday night. The department's main website is still functioning, but the news site could be offline for several days while IT personnel upgraded security. Police aren't using the term hacking yet, saying the cause of the interruption of service is being investigated. The news site was launched in 2012. It's often used by the department to post news releases about arrests made by its police officers. The Rock County Coroner's Office will close next Monday, ending 132 years of service. The new Rock County Medical Examiner's Department will take over. Local officials say the change was made to further enhance the forensic capabilities of law enforcement officials. The county board voted in September to eliminate the elected coroner position. and contract with the Dane County Medical Examiner to run an office in Rock County. People who have been working for the Rock County Coroner's Office have been given the opportunity to apply for positions in the new office. There won't be an ice castle in Eagle River this winter. The ice used to build the castle isn't thick enough. The ice is harvested from Silver Lake, where the ice is just 7 inches thick. That's 3 to 6 inches short of what's needed to make the blocks used to build the ice castle. The fire department has led the ice castle construction for the last 20 years, usually between Christmas and New Year's. The castle wasn't built in 2011 or 2012 either, because of the weather. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is an appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Three Al Jazeera journalists have begun another year in prison in Egypt. But they received some hopeful news on this New Year's Day. The country's highest court has canceled their sentences and ordered a retrial. The journalists' imprisonment for what they say was just reporting caused an outcry, and many news organizations, including NPR, demanded their release. NPR's Layla Fadel was at the courthouse in Cairo today and joins us now. Hi, Layla.
Hi.
So why were their sentences canceled? What does that mean exactly?
Well, basically, I think it shows how deeply flawed this case has been from the beginning. Both the defense lawyers and the prosecution called for a retrial, the defense saying the charges were not proven, and the prosecution questioning the constitutionality of the proceedings as a whole, according to lawyers. So today, that means that they will remain in prison, but they do get another day in court. And the 7 years that two of them got, the 10 years for the other man, have all been canceled.
Okay, so it's a do-over. They remain in prison while they wait for the do-over. What was the scene like in the courtroom today?
Well, you know, the families were extremely sad, actually. I mean, it's good news that they get to go on trial again, but it's been over a year now that they've been in prison, and another trial means more time in jail. So there was a lot of grief. They were hoping and expecting the possibility of actual release today when the sentences were canceled, but that didn't happen. And there's no date yet for the retrial. So this really means more of their lives lost sitting in prison for crimes they really say they didn't commit and that weren't proven against them.
Can you remind us what the crimes were, according to the authorities?
Well, Peter Greste, Mohamed Fahmy, and Behan Mohamed were arrested and convicted then on terrorism charges. But the evidence that was put out in court showed run-of-the-mill tools that journalists use, like cameras and notebooks, and doing things that journalists do, like taking notes and reporting, asking questions. And a lot of rights groups say that this trial was really a sham trial, and it was more political than actually criminal over a beef between Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera, and Egypt.
Oh, there were people, as you've discussed on this program before, who thought that this was actually part of power diplomacy, that these people from Qatar, or associated anyway with Qatar, were imprisoned. But now we have this situation where their sentences have been canceled. Is it possible for Egyptians then to argue that, well, their system is working?
Yes, I mean, the argument of the Egyptian state all along is put your trust in the judiciary. We cannot interfere in judicial procedures because there has been so much international pressure to release them. This court, the highest court in Egypt, has now canceled the sentence, meaning that they may soon be released. But it doesn't console the families that their sons, their fathers, their brothers have been in jail now for a year. Behan Mohamed, his baby was born while he was in jail. Mohamed Fahmy hasn't been able to get married. His fiance is waiting for him to get out. And Peter Greste's parents and family have been coming here from Australia, spending Christmas in a prison in Egypt visiting their son.
Hmm. And is there a sense of how much longer they have to wait until this retrial takes place?
It's unclear. One of the family members did say they expect a date set within the month and the trial could begin. But again, the last trial took months before they got a verdict, so that could mean another year in prison for them. There are a couple other options. There's been a recent law passed that says that foreigners can be deported if they're accused or convicted of a crime. Now, that would only apply to Peter Greste and Mohamed Fahmy if he renounces his citizenship. And the other option is a presidential pardon, but that is something that would only happen after the proceedings are completely finished.
Leila, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
That's NPR's Leila Fadel in Cairo. This is NPR News.
It's just about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us for classical music starting at 9.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
Both artists present their view of household objects. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support Wisconsin artists. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Will be a relatively mild start to the new year. Cloudy and cool, maybe some snow. Highs this afternoon in the low to mid-20s. Clouds breaking up tonight and getting very cold with lows from 4 below 0 to 5 above. It should be pretty normal for this time of year with highs mainly in the teens. Looking forward, single digits in teens on Saturday. By Monday, though, we're looking at highs in the single digits and lows from 5 to 20 below.
Contributors to WPR include Mineral Point Chamber of Commerce, Madison Country Day School, and Sustainable Engineering Group. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Some who work for the federal government on contract are due for a raise in this new year.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The federal government can't force states to raise their minimum wage levels, but it can raise wages for contractors. It'll be $10.10 an hour now that it's 2015. But as Tim Fitzsimmons reports, just how many will benefit from this is not clear.
The federal minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour. Today's jump affects only new federal contract workers. But the thing is, according to David Cooper at the Economic Policy Institute, the government barely keeps track of the contractors working for it.
I would be hesitant to even estimate a ballpark number of how many workers would be affected by that change.
Here's what we do know.
Federal contractors tend to be paid very well, even in the service positions.
That's Kevin Brancato, a defense analyst with Bloomberg Government. He says, for instance, there are lots of well-paid contractors in the area around Washington, D.C. He sees the biggest impact as being mostly regional in cheaper parts of the country.
If you have a military base, which is in the middle of nowhere, which has a relatively low cost of living, there are also going to be relatively few workers there.
It's not just the cooks and cleaners on military bases. It's the people who sell concessions at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington and the people who sew military uniforms. They'll now be making $10.10, more than other minimum wage workers. I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
To review on this January 1st, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up 7.5% for 2014. The S&P 500 did 11%. The NASDAQ Composite Index went up 13% in 2014. Your mileage will vary, especially if the portfolio was not tied to one of these indices. Can you name some Baltic countries that use the euro? Estonia, nicely done. Latvia, yes. And as of a few hours ago, the next one down using the standard Mercator map, Lithuania. If you missed our coverage of that on the air, it'll be at marketplace.org. In fact, it is there now.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Battelle. Battelle's airport bottle scanner can detect threats in seconds. Learn more at battelle.org. Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at fordfoundation.org.
There's a massive trade show being constructed in Las Vegas today, even today, supposedly a holiday. The Consumer Electronics Show, CES, opens next week, and it's the big one for e-gadgets from both the behemoths and the startups of the electronics industry. Nova Safo has more.
CES this year is preoccupied with pretty mundane objects.
Things like your toothbrush or your door locks.
That's Sean Dubrovac. He's the chief economist for the Consumer Electronics Association. Dubrovac says last year was a turning point in the move to take everyday objects and connect them to the internet. And this year, there are more such objects than ever.
So, for example, Adidas has a connected soccer ball and will measure your kick, how high it was, how fast it's rotating.
Obviously, there's privacy and security risks.
Adam Thierer, who's attending CES, is a technology policy researcher at George Mason University. He says consumers need to be more careful, but companies do too.
To make sure that these new technologies are as secure as possible and safeguard our information and do not share it too freely or openly.
Thierer says this is something a lot of companies have to think about, from marketers to entertainment producers and car makers. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
That's one trade show we'll be covering, but for a view from 30,000 feet on technology in this new year, I want to turn to my colleague Ben Johnson, host of our sibling program, Marketplace Tech. Good morning.
Hi, David.
So 2015, give me a trend.
Okay, so mobile payments. You've heard a lot about this in 2014, but I think it's actually going to be even bigger in 2015.
When you go to the cash register with the device that was in your pocket, boom, it's paid.
Yes, absolutely. And you've seen Apple release a mobile pay service, Apple Pay. This works with Apple Passbook. And all iPhone 6s will now have it. New Apple Watches, when they actually come out, will have it. We've also seen, though, a lot of growth in other services like Venmo, for instance, PayPal's mobile app. There's another app being pushed by retailers called Currency, which is more centered around coupons and loyalty programs at places like Target. But there's still a big hurdle, though, for these newer companies and payment services as well. Here's Sucharita Mupuru at Forrester.
When we've asked consumers, who do you trust most, who do you trust least, in offering something like a digital wallet, their banks are the companies they trust most. Startups are the ones they trust least.
So I think, David, this trust issue is still going to be a hurdle for newer tech companies offering newer services in this space.
Now, one policy issue that we've been covering in 2014 that's not going to go away, I don't think, is network neutrality. What do you think, Ben? Are we going to get any final determinations about whether internet service providers have to deliver data from all sources to all consumers at equal speeds?
Well, before the final decision, David, as you know, from Game of Thrones comes the final battle, right? So in January 2014, we saw Verizon win this court fight against the Federal Communications Commission's proposed rules about net neutrality. Early this year, we're going to see another set of proposed rules from the FCC. What's interesting is the FCC might actually try and do something called Title II, where it would essentially say that internet service providers are utilities. They're public utilities and thus can be regulated and controlled by the FCC as such.
And even if the FCC pursues this Title II thing,
yeah,
we do have a Republican majority in both houses coming in, and they might have a different view.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. The new Congress could make things really interesting this year because the GOP does not appear to support net neutrality. And some Republicans are talking about passing legislation that would preempt the FCC's new rules. One of the other things on Congress's list this year is looking at the laws that actually govern the FCC itself. That could be a scary thing for FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler. He might not have the same powers with the FCC going forward.
All right. My good friend and host of our companion program, our sibling program, Marketplace Tech, Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
And before we go, let us conjure an image in our heads. Think of the office kitchen. Grody plates left unwashed, coffee grounds drifting around on formica like dust devils. The Los Angeles Times has a piece about companies that are rethinking the office kitchen and turning them into collaborative workspaces that just happen to have microwaves and coffee makers. Kitchens are the collaborative space at home. Why not the office? This is a far cry from the television station I once saw in San Francisco that made its entire break room an iridescent red, furniture included, apparently after consultants suggested the painful color would dissuade people from spending any time there. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Our weather in Wisconsin today should be cloudy and cool with a chance of snow and afternoon highs in the low to mid-20s. Clouds breaking up tonight
with lows dipping from 4 below zero to 5 above.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Honoring personal legacies in the circle of life, they believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
You're listening to WGTD HD,